You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Wednesday, July 19th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, repeal and replace dead. Trump pushing for repeal only and pretending he's not a Republican. Meanwhile, the press also pretends Trump voters are different from Republicans. Mitch McConnell still very, very lonely. And the coming Republican debt default should be here before Halloween. Over the summer, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is going to be facing off against the Trump administration. And EPA's toxic office chief, a biostitute and Bible science writer. Meanwhile, Trump Jr.'s are miserable as told in People magazine. We will tell you all of the tidbits of the sad, sad story.
That really calibrates your board.
Meanwhile, new dishes inside Trump world. And speaking of Trump, he had an impromptu meeting with his boy toy, Vlad Putin.
I think you're confusing who is toy.
At a G20 summit. I don't know how nefarious it is as much as it is just terrifying that he is alone talking to anybody.
Yes, Angela Merkel is too. We already established this. When you give us codes,
exactly.
You don't have them. Mattis is having them. Whole chain of command ruined.
Vladimir is so out of his depth here.
All this.
Merkel's a two?
And more.
Oh, Michael?
On today's program. It wasn't. Michael is just in character.
No,
he
I
can't.
Think.
I've heard him say.
No, I thought it was generous, like on the part of Putin. Not well, Michael. But
he's just going along with
it.
I think
it's more the joke that Putin's just tired of hearing it, and he just wants to establish.
Yeah,
a number
got that
and move
part.
On.
Just impressed by Putin's generosity.
I'm less moved by that meeting that they had in front of the G20. I just don't think. Aside from. Just the idea of Donald Trump speaking to any world leader without someone there to hold his hand.
Got it under control.
I'm a little bit concerned about. But
right, like
more
you don't
relevant.
Want him meeting with like the Prime Minister of Antigua.
Right, exactly.
It's like a general principle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
More interesting to me is that eighth guy who is apparently in the meeting with Donald Trump Jr., someone who is. Has been accused, I want to be careful when I say this, has been accused of massive amounts of money laundering for Russian real estate interests. I mean,
it's so weird how that keeps popping up.
Anyways, we will get to all of that. I want to start off, there's a couple of things. I've got a couple of bees in my bonnet. One, I want to just give a full accounting of how the repeal and replace fell apart, because it's going to be instructive. Now, there is another vote that's supposedly happening next week. Contrary to our good friend Doug, the constitutionalist who doesn't know anything about the Constitution, and Trump supporter who doesn't seem to know anything about Trump, who argued yesterday that this is exactly what Trump wanted. He wanted this bill to go down and because he wants Obamacare to fail. Donald Trump has begged Mitch McConnell for a week before they vote on a full repeal so that he can meet with senators to convince them to do what apparently he doesn't want to have happen done.
But do you think that any time, sometimes when, and I don't know if Doug is still suspended from Twitter because of Matt, but do you think that sometimes when Trump says people are saying, he's specifically thinking of Doug?
It's possible.
He might have seen something Doug tweeted.
People are saying that. How I don't want to. We will get to the other thing. The bee in my bonnet. I got bumped from doing Hayes last night. All well and good, but I had to read this piece in the New Yorker, which I had actually decided to read, had seen before, but I hadn't quite gotten to it yet. And you're going to see this increasingly, and you're going to see it from Republicans, and you're going to see it from the center, and maybe you'll even see it from the left. Everybody's got an agenda here in trying to argue that Trump supporters are somehow unique from Republican voters. But there's a nickname that I have coined for Trump's base, and I call them Republican voters. We will talk more about that as we go forward.
I call them not good guys.
Not good guys. Meanwhile, let me just do the story which I had teased yesterday, but I haven't gotten to. The private student loan business seems to have a bit of a problem. And I got to say, I'm enjoying this. Now, I would rather just a broad jubilee as a matter of policy, but I think it's highly beneficial for there to be a de facto jubilee. Now, you know there's almost $1 trillion worth of student loans. Maybe it's over $1 trillion. And I'm not quite sure how much of that is private student loans. I think it's about 100 billion, maybe 10%, maybe a little bit more. Maybe it's 150 billion, somewhere in there. And as of now, it appears at least within $5 billion worth of loans, the private loan companies, which have been which own these loans now, have run into the same problem that we saw during the mortgage crisis. And this was just an element of the mortgage crisis. It wasn't a cause of the mortgage crisis, although it was a handmaiden, if you will. You'll recall that what was going on in the mortgage business was that all of these loans were being bundled up and then securitized so that they could be sold in a secondary market. And then they were chopped up more, and then the subsidiary securities were made from these first securities. And it got to the point where there was no way to go in the mortgage business. If you own a lien on a house because you have financed it, you've got to go file that with a county clerk, literally the county clerk. Well, they couldn't do this and keep selling the loan over and over again. So they developed their own system called MERS. It stands for something I can't remember off the top of my head what it is. And but they did their own system despite the laws that exist about the way you're supposed to transfer ownership of these notes. So when people's homes were foreclosed upon, they would go to court and the banks or the entities that own the loans had to basically have robo-signers, fake affidavits saying, we own this loan, I've seen it, blah, blah, blah. And the courts were not terribly sympathetic to homeowners, frankly. They allowed this to slide. Well, they're not allowing this to slide in the student loan business. So what's happened is judges have already dismissed, according to the New York Times, dozens of lawsuits against former students, wiping out their debt because the documents proving who owns the loans are missing. This is taking place in most of the loans come from the National Collegiate Student Loan Trusts. And in a what I find a sort of funny legal filing as I read this story. National Collegiate lawyers warned in a recent filing, as news of the servicing issues and the trust's inability to produce the documents needed to foreclose on loans spread. In other words, because we can't prove that we own these loans, and as news of that spreads, let's say through somebody doing a podcast, the likelihood of more defaults rise. Because people out there might go, hey, wait a second. I got a private student loan from National Collegiate Student Loan Trust. I wonder if they have my papers.
I'm going to cover this again tomorrow.
National Collegiate is an umbrella name for 15 trusts that hold 800,000 private student loans totaling $12 billion. More than $5 billion of that debt is in default, according to court filings. I mean, who knows? People may just... Now, I don't know if you can ask for proof that someone has your loan or how you go about doing that, but I'm sure one could Google and find it. It tells the story of Times tells the story of a woman who was the first in her family to go to college, took out private loans to finance her studies. She had trouble following the fine print. I didn't really understand things like interest rates. Everybody tells you to go to college, get an education, and everything will be okay. So that's what I did. I mean, I have a year of law school. I was raised by a dad who made me actually write contracts when I borrowed $15 from him.
Oh, Jesus, that's just so much clicking into place right now.
And I don't understand these. I don't understand these documents. And I don't understand these dynamics very well. Ms. Watson made some of her payments on her loan, but fell behind when her daughter got sick. Because, of course, we live in a country where if you get sick, it should mean financial ruin. She had to quit her job as an executive assistant. She now works as a nurse's aide with more flexible hours, but a smaller paycheck that barely covers her family's expenses. When National Collegiate sued her, the paperwork it submitted was a mess. This is according to her lawyer of the New York Legal Assistance Group. And she said some of the loans it charged her with having, she never took out. When a judge in New York City civil court saw all the documents, dismissed four lawsuits against Ms. Watson, the trust failed to establish the chain of title on Ms. Watson's loans. You'll recall David Dayan wrote a book about this in the mortgage industry entitled Chain of Title. Lawsuits have been tossed out in New Hampshire, Ohio, and Texas. Often what happens, these trusts wins their lawsuit automatically because the loaner doesn't show up. And then they're saddled with this. They can garnish their Social Security. They can garnish all sorts of different things. So always question these things, folks. And if you have a private student loan, might be worth to find out who owns it. I'm not saying anything. I think it's a contract. I don't know if it's legal to encourage people to break their contract. I'm not talking to anybody individual. I'm just telling a story I read in the New York Times. So
I read a lot of stories.
Yeah, I read a lot of stories.
There's a lot of stories, and I think frankly we need to figure out what the hell is going on.
All right. Let's figure out what the hell is going on with repeal and replace is dead for the time being. It's very hard for me to believe that they can leave it here like this because it is such a devastating loss for the president, for Mitch McConnell. But I don't know that they have any choice. I mean, this is This is the kind of stuff that, you know, is frontline Wikipedia when they look back on your legislative career. Here, just to remind you, is Donald Trump. 9 months ago, October 25th, Sanford, Florida, surrounded by, there's even a doctor, or at least a guy who plays one on TV, standing behind him with a stethoscope. I don't know if that's actually Donald Trump's actual doctor there just to take his pulse.
But he's better groomed.
He's better
groomed. Can we put that guy in a doctor's outfit and the stethoscope? He just looks like a doctor.
And here is Donald Trump telling everyone his plans for health care.
My first day in office, I'm going to ask Congress to put a bill on my desk getting rid of this disastrous law and replacing it with reforms that expand choice, freedom, affordability. You're going to have such great health care at a tiny fraction of the cost, and it's going to be so easy.
So easy. Meanwhile, Donald Trump now is talking about healthcare failure in terms of the Republicans and the Democrats. And I was over here just doing my job by just waiting, golfing, looking at fire trucks. Big, big fire trucks. Where's the fire? That is a quote, incidentally.
Where's the fire? I'll put it out.
And like I say, despite the fact that some people will tell you this is his plan all along, to have this long protracted battle that is very highly embarrassing to him and to those people he is looking upon to pass his agenda, the president has continuing this charade by inviting all 52 Republican senators to the White House for lunch today, Wednesday, to see if he can revive the Republican plans to repeal and replace the health care law. I can't wait. Can't wait to hear the leak that comes out of this lunch.
Hey, how's everyone doing? Who would have ever thought it would have been this hard? By the way, I thought the Senate bill was pretty mean. Mitch, very mean. Not good.
You did a bad job.
You did a bad job. And at the same time, Susan Collins is a horrible woman.
All right. Well, let's get to this.
Bleeding out of her. Well, I guess she doesn't bleed anymore because she's ancient.
Oh, my God. No.
That's not right. Wrong. All right.
It's just wrong.
So, Rush Limbaugh.
You're not wrong, Kelly. It's wrong.
Understand the scurrying that's going to, that is happening here. And we've got a clip of Sean Hannity doing his, 45th version over the past, 15, maybe 10 years of, I've left the Republican Party. I'm an independent. This is the last straw. No more chances. One more chance. That's it.
I'm a constitutional conservative before I'm a Republican.
Right, exactly. But before we get there, Rush Limbaugh has figured out exactly who is responsible for the failure of this Republican repeal and replace. And, of course, it's the ladies.
Now we find out the Republican caucus in the Senate is infected with essentially leftist members. Collins, Murkowski, Capito. These three female leftists in the Republican caucus are running the Senate, not Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell is not running the Senate. These three women are running the Senate. The conservative Republicans in the Senate are not running the Senate. Three liberal women who call themselves Republicans are running the Senate.
Yes. Now, what's interesting about his comment that these three liberal infecting women run the Senate is that the reality is that there were a man and a woman who had said that they weren't going to vote for it. Rand Paul, a conservative, according to him, and Susan Collins. And then the bill collapsed, not because of Capito, who was certainly going to Capito, and not because of Murkowski, who also hadn't announced anything publicly, because she was also going to Capito.
What are you talking about?
The bill died when arch-conservative Mike Lee of Utah and conservative, but also fairly pragmatic, Jerry Moran of Kansas joined together and said they could not support the current bill. That's when it collapsed. And the story of Moran in particular, saying that he couldn't support the current bill, is very instructive and is, as far as I can tell, a direct result of, you want to call it the resistance, of activists who fought against this bill. Dave Weigel, July 6th in the Washington Post, writing on behalf of the CIA, maybe. Weigel was actually in Kansas reporting. He was at a town hall with Senator Jerry Moran, which is the first town hall meeting since coming out against the then version of the Senate's health care bill. He didn't want the legislation jammed through on a party line vote, but he would not necessarily vote against it. In other words, he was one of those waivers at the time. And there was a bunch of them after the first version. Remember? McConnell had to go back. And he said he'd met people who tell me they're better off because the Affordable Care Act was passed, but he knew plenty of people were hurting too. This is a guy back in 2015 who was vehemently against Obamacare. But he had this town hall meeting. Planned Parenthood transported at least 20 people from the Kansas City suburbs. The city's chapter of Indivisible did the same. The American Association for Retired People and Alliance for Healthy Kansas made more calls, driving loyal voters to Palco, where the town hall took place. The result was a polite but heated round of questions that Moran occasionally chose not to answer. A 59-year-old vet asked if it was time for Medicare for All. Moran had to wait for the applause to die down and then moved on to the topic of Medicaid funding. Moran largely allowed the skeptics of the Republican bill to frame the whole conversation. For all 90 minutes, a woman named Yanith Porch, 46, stood behind the senator holding up a sign with caricatures of Republican leaders and the warning, "When you lose your health care, remember who took it away." They didn't try and move her. This took place in a place called Rooks County, which gave Donald Trump a 73-point landslide over Hillary Clinton. Moran beat a token Democratic opponent by 79 points, and still he was afraid. He said he did not describe the task facing Republicans as repeal. It was now repeal, repair, replace, whatever language people are using. In 2015, he said this: Obamacare was ran through Congress on a poorly partisan basis in the face of significant public opposition. He said he ran in 2015 on full repeal. After the town hall meeting, Moran told reporters the version of the GOP's bill that he opposed put too much of Medicaid at risk.
"This is Susan Collins. Mitch, we need to seize the means of production. I won't vote for any bill that doesn't criminalize the insurance industry."
Now, it is unclear whether or not Senator Jerry Moran is a female.
"He's having a gender operation."
Meanwhile, Mike Lee also jettisoned the bill, and this is sort of fascinating. Ted Cruz, remember Ted Cruz had this amendment, right? Which basically said, it's the freedom of choice amendment. And that is, insurers can sell Obamacare compliant policies in the individual market, on the exchanges, or I should say in the individual market, there would be no exchanges. And if they do, they are also allowed to sell a non-Obamacare compliant policy. So in other words, one that has lifetime caps, one that has annual caps, one that doesn't deal with pre-existing conditions, one that doesn't require essential health benefits, et cetera, et cetera. Which would presumably be much cheaper because, of course, it's barely insurance. But there became such fear about the implications of that amendment that they made one tweak to it before it came out as part of the bill. Kimberly Leonard wrote about this. I'm not sure in which... in which magazine, Kimberly Leonard. But she wrote about this and laid it out. And what that one change tweaked was that insurers, even though they could sell different policies, they had to put all of the people into the same risk pool because there was a concern about adverse selection where... She was in the U.S. News and World Report. There was a concern about adverse selection, where if you had an Obamacare compliant policy and a non-compliant policy, all the healthy people who presume that they're not going to need health insurance are going to go for the non-compliant one because they're never going to need their health insurance. They may be wrong, but that's their they're going to look that way on actuarial tables. And the sicker and older people are going to go for the compliant policy because they know they're going to need their health insurance. And for insurance companies to be able to sell the cheaper version, they need to keep those two risk pools separate. But the tweak said there'll be one single risk pool. Now, as you try and wrap your heads around that, understand that you're not the only one who couldn't figure that out. Most health insurance experts who were aware of that provision were like, we have no idea how to do that. We don't know how to put everybody into the same risk pool, but sell different policies, such dramatically different policies to them. The American Academy of Actuaries released a paper saying that creating a single risk pool is unworkable because insurers would have difficulty administering different sets of rules and premium rates for customers that are very different while keeping them in the same risk pool. And this is what Mike Lee objected to. He knew that this was either a disaster or just a BS move. And he also dropped out, crashing the bill. So that's the story of how repeal and replace died, ladies and gentlemen. A combination of right-wing lunacy, right? The Lees and the Pauls fundamentally disagree in the idea that government has any type of responsibility in assuring that people have legitimate access to health care in every situation. And then from senators who were just afraid of people who believe those things, who believe that, hey, man, we're living in a civilized society, the wealthiest society in the world, in the history of the world. People should not have to quit their jobs because their kids get sick. They shouldn't have to default on their student loans. They shouldn't have to foreclose on their houses. They shouldn't have to declare bankruptcy. They shouldn't have to become amateur accountants. They shouldn't have to be stuck in jobs they don't want to be stuck in. They shouldn't have this source of stress any more than we expect in a civilized country not to have to worry about pirates raiding us. It's just we've replaced the boogeyman.
Pirates have actually done a lot for the economy. And maybe if you had some of their entrepreneurial instincts and you weren't just so committed. And by the way, you talk about faith. I mean, you need to have faith in it. Don't you believe in Yahweh or whatever you guys call it before you lend money to people and charge an exorbitant interest rate? And that's why you keep that little thing on your head or whatever. I mean, but at a certain point, you just got to believe. And Mitch McConnell came to me and I could see that theoretically there might be a scenario where a kid might be able to get a slightly more affordable an inhaler. And I was just like, I can't vote for this. And he was showing me all the things. You know, people, it's going to make them bankrupt. People are going to lose their health care. I said, that's great, but I'm still seeing this inhaler line, so I can't get on board.
I mean, this is all it took. It took Jerry Moran. You know, Mike Leed, I don't think he could have jumped into the pool alone. He needed to find somebody, and Jerry Moran jumped in with him because of the people who showed up at those town hall meetings. Literally hundreds of people showing up and thousands who wrote to him. Maybe 10,000, I don't know, 50,000, maybe 5,000, maybe 3,000. A drop in the bucket crashed this. A drop in the bucket. This is the thing that people don't understand about politics. When it's not about elections. The dirty little secret about this, and I just remember having to explain this to people who were like, you're preaching to the choir. Guess what? It's the choir who determines this stuff. After the elections, it's the choir who change the trajectory of broad policies in this country. So congratulations to all of you who wrote letters, made phone calls, went to town halls, etc. Meanwhile, Sean Hannity is sort of arguing he's going to leave the Republican Party for, I believe, like the 30th time in maybe 10 years. Yeah, I mean, if you listen to his radio, the conservative in exile movement, he made a big deal about becoming an independent, not a Republican registered. He's probably still registered Republican. I mean, who knows? But the bottom line is, like, he's stuck with a problem where he has to complain about the Republicans. He's not taking the Rush Limbaugh tack of blaming the women who have infected his party. Because Hannity is very sensitive about how poorly he does with women in ratings.
Rush needs to think more about that stuff with some of his travel schedule.
But here is Hannity talking about how this is all the fault of those Republicans over there, as if he's not been one of those people calling for these victories.
Pay very close attention if you're in the D.C. swamp. I have a very important message for you, congressional Republicans. I and so many of us in the country, we have run out of patience with you. You are the do-nothing GOP lawmakers. And up to now, to be very, very honest, and it's really sad, you're pretty useless. And all you have now is excuses and broken promises. Remember 2010, vote for us, give us the House, we'll get rid of Obamacare. Well, which the American people did. You got the House in 2010. In 2014, you said, give us the House and the Senate. And we delivered, the people delivered. And then in 2016, you said, give us the House and Senate and the White House, and then once and for all, we'll repeal Obamacare. Okay, let's remind this audience exactly what they were promised so there's no ambiguity here. Take a look.
There's only one way to truly fix Obamacare, only one way, and that's a full repeal. A full repeal. That's been our goal from the start. That's our goal now. And we plan to achieve it.
It's clear that any serious attempt to improve our health care system must begin with full repeal and replacement of Obamacare, a mission I remain fully committed to fighting on behalf of the people of Arizona.
Repealing Obamacare's poorly crafted and misguided mandates and replacing the law with a fiscally responsible reform bill that contains costs and provides more choices is the best path forward.
You can't repair this monstrosity. You got to tear it down and start all over
again. How do you get to that point, though?
When they lose elections.
And do you think that's the key, that the Republicans have to take the Senate, and from that point you can have a different strategy?
Yeah, the ones who survive in 2016 or up in 2016 are going to have a different attitude.
There you go.
You know, this was the Republicans' big chance, and up till now they've completely blown it.
Up to now.
Now, since 2011. Remember the Republican-controlled House? They have voted a whopping 68 times to repeal, defund, delay parts of Obamacare. Guess what? I guess it now turns out they were all phony show votes because they never used the power of the purse. Where is the decisive action? You know, was this all a big game, a giant fraud perpetrated on the American people? Well, now you Republicans, you face a moment of truth. This is a tipping point.
This is a tipping point. I've been to this place. Was this all a fraud? Yeah. Yes, it was. In fact, you were part of it. Just FYI.
This is Senator Susan Collins. We need to replace Obamacare with a nationalized system. What do HMOs and insurance companies bring to the table? Mitch, don't walk away from me. I'm infecting you. Can't get away from us. We're the leftist female caucus. Bernie's a total wuss bag compared to us.
Let me just talk about this because I just got to get this out of my system. So there's a piece in the New Yorker magazine. Well, let me just start with this one. This is from Wall Street Journal, and it's written by a guy, Jason L. Riley, who's from the Manhattan Institute. A pro-immigration Republican type guy. So clearly against the vast majority of the Republican Party. But he will still promote this fiction entitled The President's Base versus the Republican Party. There is no difference between Donald Trump's base and the Republican Party. People got to get this through their head. There are people who may have come out to vote for Trump who hadn't voted in the past. And there were certainly some people who voted for Obama that voted for Trump. And that's a very important cohort. It's also, relatively speaking, an infinitesimally small cohort. The vast, it's even understating it to say the vast majority of people who voted for Donald Trump voted for Mitt Romney and voted for John McCain. Even saying the vast majority is an understatement. And this guy writes as if this is not the Republican Party. The GOP's inability to scrap Obamacare this week means, among other things, that President Trump will end his first 6 months in office without a major legislative accomplishment. And one question is, how much his supporters care? This is the big thing now. The Republicans don't seem... The Trump voters don't seem to care about legislative victories. They don't seem to care about policy. NBC News polling gives the president a 40% job approval rating among all voters, while 55% disapprove. In counties Mr. Trump won last year, however, voters still back him by 50 to 46%. In other words, in Republican counties, they still support Donald Trump. And he goes on to... His disapproval rating has climbed 5 points to 58%. Yet among Republican voters, his favorability has barely budged and remains above 80%. And he's going to forget that. He's going to forget that number he just put out. 41% of all voters believe the Trump campaign helped Russia to try and influence the election. But that belief is shared by fewer than 1 in 10 Republican voters. The average Trump supporter's concern about Russia roughly matches his concern about president's unreleased tax returns or witching hour tweets. And then he goes on and he does the little shift. I spoke to someone from the Brookings Institute. And there's blue-collar jobs in traditional primary and secondary industries are gradually disappearing. Mr. Trump's ability to appeal to these voters is the reason he won and the reason his base isn't abandoning him. His base doesn't give a crap about that because his base is exactly the same people who voted for Mitt Romney who said those jobs are never coming back. Exactly the same people. And exactly the same people as John McCain, who voted for John McCain. There's a sliver of people. And we're not even sure if they voted for Trump as much as voted against Hillary Clinton for a myriad of reasons. Emily Eakins, a Cato Institute scholar, is part of a politically diverse team of academics and pollsters in the process of analyzing the 2016 election, told me on Monday that Trump supporters are less concerned about his policy agenda and more interested in having someone who understands them occupy the Oval Office. In other words, Trump voters are tribal. In other words, Republican voters are tribal. Now, this isn't to say that Democratic voters, at least a certain amount of them, are not tribal. But Democratic voters seem far more interested in a broad range of issues. I think there's a lot of evidence to support the idea that Trump's main appeal was validating the fears and concerns of a certain segment of Americans who felt they were being ignored by elites in the media, elites in politics, elite Republicans. Yeah. Nobody was articulating that Barack Obama wasn't an American citizen. We'll vote for Romney because at least he went to New York and kissed Trump's ring, who was the chief invalidator of President Obama. This is of little comfort to Republicans in Congress. Unlike the president, GOP lawmakers must face voters next year and desperately want some legislative victories to campaign on. Well, he probably does too. But when they vote for those Republicans, it's going to be for the same thing, right? To vote against those San Francisco Democrats who don't live in their district. And this isn't just a right-winger who's trying to maintain the credibility of the Republican Party. Peter Hessler in The New Yorker, How Trump is Transforming Rural America. And it's all about this county in Colorado where people are unshook, where they voted for Trump and they organized for Trump. And things galvanized when they had the deplorable there. And people admitted that, like, I just like the fact that he gets up every day and he tweets out and he slams the media. And I wasn't swayed by the Access Hollywood tape. And
might have been enhanced by the Access Hollywood tape.
Yeah. And the descriptions of inner-city crime seem cartoonish to urban residents, but not to rural voters. Trump won nearly 65% of the vote in Mesa County. Everything he said activated people to vote for him, almost 65%. And they're still with him. And we need to understand this. We're going to write this up in the New Yorker because all you East Coast and West Coast liberal elites, you need to understand this. 65% of them almost voted for this guy. What's going on? Well, in 2008, nearly 64% of them voted for John McCain. Ew. And in 2012, 64.5% of them voted for Mitt Romney. In fact, that is more than the 64.10.1, which is not nearly 65%, if we're going to split hairs. Mitt Romney beat Donald Trump in this district, in this county. Barack Obama got 32% of the vote in 2008. He got 34% of it in 2012. And Hillary Clinton, if there's any political story to be taken out of this, Hillary Clinton lost 4 percentage points to Gary Johnson. Period. End of story. That's the only change that took place over the course of 3 elections that people really didn't like Hillary Clinton there, and she lost about 15% of her support to Gary Johnson. Didn't even go to Donald Trump. Didn't even go to Donald Trump. Mitt Romney outperformed Donald Trump in Mesa County, Colorado. The idea of writing this piece, I mean, it's interesting. But the piece should not be what Donald Trump has done to Mesa County or how Trump is transforming rural America. To the extent that that area was transformed, it dropped in support for the Republican candidate by 0.4%, by 0.04%. No, this should be the story of, holy crap, look at these Republican voters, completely exposed. They would vote for John McCain. They would vote for Mitt Romney. They would vote for Donald Trump. They would vote for anybody with an R on their last name because of how much they hate Democrats, how much they hate liberal elites, whatever it is. How little they care about policy. It doesn't matter. That's the real story. They're not transforming anything. He's exposing the Republican Party for what it is. You want to do a story? You go to Wisconsin, you go to Michigan, you go to Pennsylvania. What changed there? And the story very well may be voter suppression and a Democratic candidate who had too much baggage. But this is like the equivalent of the National Review going to Brooklyn in 2009 say they're Obama voters who still support him.
The transformation of Brooklyn.
It's unbelievable. This place is
Park
just like
Slope you voters can just see the vote way. For
yeah.
Obama.
You should just see the way they talk to each other now. It's all very careful not to be offensive with their language, and it's just bizarre. That, I mean, can you imagine that piece?
It sounds pretty funny.
I just had to get that off my chest.
Sam, this is Senator Susan Collins from Maine. You know why I opposed Obama?
Because you're a lady.
I thought, very demeaning of my work as a revolutionary, but I thought the way that he threw Reverend Wright under the bus was offensive. And as I say in my state, Oongawa, black power. Healthcare for all, nationalize the means of production. Me and Lisa and Nancy have our little Marx and Engels reading group. And Mitch is very afraid of us.
We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. Folks, remember, it is your membership that makes this show possible. We cannot do this show without your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you hours and hours of more content every day. You can listen to one part and not listen to the other. You can do whatever.
So many hours.
So many hours.
So many more hours than you could
also,
ever.
Also, you'll recall that we are the 4-time award-winning program.
Podcast.
If you go to podcastawards.com right now, you can help make us a 5-time winner of the podcast awards. Go to podcastawards.com. You got to register. You got to give me your email address and nominate us. The voting won't start for another couple of weeks, but we need more nominations.
We're going to win so much, it'll make you sick.
It's going to make you so sick.
So sick.
So nauseous. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Also, don't forget to check out Trademark BS, or as Michael likes to call it, the Michael Brooks Show on Patreon. What's the number today?
1 second.
Seriously?
Yeah, actually, seriously.
You don't have push alerts coming?
It is at 308. Thank Whoa! You, everyone. Thank you.
Broke through the 300 barrier.
Yes, sir. Thank you, thank you.
All right, quick break. See you in the fun half.
No, 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 no. Things are looking bad.